MediTalk with Dr. Ross Walker.
Good afternoon, Dr. Ross Walker. How are you?
I'm very well, thank you, mate. It's lovely to talk
good.
To you.
Likewise, mate. Look, I've got heaps of questions. We could do this entire half hour just on questions that I've been
totally
sent
what you want to do.
For you. Let me just ask you a couple. Here we go. This is from Matthew, okay?
Yep.
Matthew says, I have been on blood thinners for the last week because I have a clot in my lower leg. And I'll be on them for 3 months. Can you ask Dr. Ross Walker whether I can walk, as in exercise, for 1.5 hours per day? Is that okay? He said my doctor is away for the week.
Yeah, no, look, I'd prefer him not to do this until there's evidence that the clot is completely dissolved, because the problem is, just say you've got a 3 or 4 centimetre clot in the deep veins and you start to do too much activity, what you can do is dislodge that clot, even if you're on blood thinners, can travel into the lungs and cause what we call a pulmonary emboli. So, no, I'd prefer him to just do light exercise. He could certainly walk around, but I wouldn't want any heavy exercise, an hour and a half in the gym or an hour and a half of heavy walking, until it's been demonstrated that the clot appears to have be almost mended or almost completely gone. And the question I'd ask, I mean, I don't know how old Matthew is, but why has he had a clot in the first place? So he was probably immobilised and the clot's occurred. But the problem is, people sit on a plane from here to Heathrow, and in the economy section, they come off with a big swollen leg and they've got a deep venous thrombosis and they want to sue Qantas. They should be suing their relatives for giving them the genes that thicken their blood, because 1% of people in the community have this genetic abnormality in their blood, typically a thing called factor V Leiden, a thing called prothrombin complex, anti-cardiolipin antibodies, a whole lot of different things that can thicken your blood. But you've got to find out what that is and do something about it, because if someone has that and they have a spontaneous clot, you don't just go on the blood thinners for 3 months. Sometimes you need to be on them for the rest of your life. So I think there's a few issues there, but I wouldn't go hard at it until it's been demonstrated the clot's dissolving.
This is from Jeff. Jeff says, I just turned 77 years of age. My doctor has diagnosed my symptoms as labyrinthitis, not vertigo. He says, lack of balance when going to walk, fine when standing still, sitting and laying, no dizziness, vision problems, nausea, ear infections, hearing problems, slightly lightheaded sometimes. This appeared last Christmas for approximately 4 days, Easter approximately 3 days, and started again yesterday. CT scan has showed nothing. Any ideas on how to treat this, please, from Jeff?
Yeah, sure. Firstly, often people are diagnosed with labyrinthitis or vertigo. It's a bit overdone. So there are three different types of dizziness. The first is what we call vertigo. So vertigo, labyrinthitis, I mean, it's just a name. It doesn't matter what the diagnosis is. It's a problem with the inner ear. So the little bones in the inner ear get a bit calcified. The hair cells don't work as well. And then you get some infection that inflames those areas and they get a lot of fluid in them. And you get the feeling of vertigo, which is you looking at something and that's spinning in front of you. So it's going shung, shung, shung in front of your eyes. That's vertigo. That's true vertigo. Often it's worse when you're lying down. It's not so bad when you're walking, although it can be. And if it's peripheral vertigo, so it's just purely in the inner ear, it's often associated with nausea, sometimes vomiting, and unsteadiness on the feet. But that's pure vertigo or labyrinthitis. So the name, there's a benign positional vertigo, or it's all similar things, mate. It's all, and the treatment of that, acutely, you can get across the counter a thing called Phenergan, 25 milligrams. It's an old antihistamine. Take a half one of those at night because it's quite sedating, but that can settle down the acute episode. Good old-fashioned Valium's not bad for this as well. Even people think, oh, Valium's for anxiety, but it also works for vertigo. And there are stronger drugs. There's a drug called beta-histine that works as well for vertigo. But definitive treatment, once you've excluded other conditions, say your CT of your brain or your MRI of the brain's normal, so there's nothing like an acoustic neuroma causing this or another condition we call Meniere's disease. So if all that's been excluded, your hearing's normal, etc., you don't have tinnitus, it's just vertigo. You go off to a physiotherapy a physiotherapist who's expert in this area, and they give you a set of neck exercises that can break up the crystals in your inner ear and you get better. So that's number one. Number two is what we call presyncope. Now, presyncope, where the blood flow up to the engine room, i.e. the skull, gets reduced for some reason. So your heart might go into an irregular rhythm. Your heart might stop for a few seconds. You don't get enough blood up to the head. And you feel like you're going to black out. So it's a feeling that everything's going black and you could collapse. That is not vertigo. That is what we call presyncope. And sometimes you even collapse. Often you need a pacemaker or you need to have your heart investigated as far as that goes. But the commonest cause of dizziness is what we call disequilibrium. And it's often misdiagnosed by many, many doctors and health practitioners as vertigo when it's disequilibrium. Now, the difference is disequilibrium is typically a disorder of the neck. And I see this all the time. People say, oh, doctor, I feel a bit wonky. I veer to one side when I walk. And what they've done is they've injured their neck in some way, which has then affected the blood flow going through the back of the neck. So you need work on the neck. So I like to, firstly, as always with everything, make a proper diagnosis and then give treatment based on that proper diagnosis.
Gee, that was a thorough answer. Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Labyrinthitis.
Yep.
Does that mean the labyrinth is affected?
Well, it depends what you're talking about as being the labyrinth. The labyrinth being the part, the labyrinth is just the system in the inner ear.
Okay, so, and is there a left and a right labyrinth?
Yeah, you got one on both sides.
The doctor told me, this is the ear, nose and throat surgeon told me, that some people, you can actually have the lab, if I'm getting my terminology right, Rossi, you can actually have, if it gets too bad, the labyrinth removed, one labyrinth removed, because there are two, and if one is causing you problems, you can have that removed, and the brain learns to work with just the other side. Is that
sure.
correct, Ross?
Yeah, that's correct, but that would be like killing an ant with a sledgehammer. You'd have to have pretty serious labyrinthitis that was refractory to all the other things I said. So this is the way I practice medicine. I always try the simplest things first, and
yes.
I go to the heavier things if the simplest things don't work. And the best definitive treatment for people who have, say, recurrent benign positional vertigo, which is a form of labyrinthitis, is to go to the physiotherapist and get the specialised exercises that get rid of the break up the crystals, basically.
Okay. This is from Susan. 2 weeks ago, your great doctor, he mentioned the use of Nexium.
Yep.
It seems to give me a few problems, Susan
yep.
says, and I would like to change. Would you kindly mention the name of the two tablets that he recommended, as I did not write it down? Now, you're going to mention two tablets. What's the first one? Starts with a T.
Tarzac and Nizac.
Okay. Now, what Tarzac, can I tell you, you cannot get Tarzac in this country at the moment.
Can't you?
No. I tried. I went to four different pharmacists, and it comes from China, and you cannot get it. They will not have supplies back in this country until at least Christmas time.
Well, in Nizac then, so N-I-Z-A-C. Now, let me say, these come from a group of drugs called H2 blockers. And the old days, you may remember a drug that was out about 25 years ago, used very commonly, called cimetidine. And cimetidine was used for a long time until we then got Zantac, which is ranitidine. So they're all the iodine's drugs. And they block the H2 receptors in the stomach. So it's turns down acid production, whereas the PPIs like Nexium, Pariet, Somac, those sort of drugs, the azole drugs, so pantoprazole, those type of drugs, they switch off acid production in the stomach. Now, so they're much more effective at treating reflux than Tarzac or Nizac or Zantac. Zantac's been taken off the market, unfortunately, because they said there was some contaminants in it. Never actually caused a clinical issue, but Zantac was a great drug. But anyhow, that aside, the problem with the long-term use of PPIs, Nexium, Somac and Pariet, the problem with those is that people who use them for more than 5 years, there is a modest increase in dementia, double the risk for heart attack, because it damages the lining of the blood vessels called the endothelium. And also there's a weak but definite slight increase in the risk for gastric cancers by switching off acid production, because the very simple cancer prevention technique, my friend, is to use the organ for what it was designed for. So the best example there is you've got a couple of things in your chest called your lungs, which were strangely designed for a thing called breathing, not to put a white stick in your mouth and soak in the smoke. And in the same way, the acid was designed to secrete, the stomach was designed to secrete acid to break up the food. So if you switch off acid production, you can cause damage long term. But reflux, many people listening would say, oh, Doc, I get dreadful reflux, and the only thing that works is Nexium. So what I say is to take Tarzac when you can get it, or Nizac, every day, and on the days you get bad reflux, to use a Nexium maybe once or twice a week. You're not going to get all the problems that I've just mentioned if you only use it once or twice a week. So that's what I would suggest in that situation. And also, the old style things like Gaviscon and Mylanta work for acute reflux as well, to use as well, because I just don't like people using these very, very strong drugs. They have very strong effects, but they also have very strong long-term side effects.
Thank you for that. We've got more questions, but let's move on to some of the things that you have sent me, of the topics. There are certain gut conditions that may be an early warning for signs of Parkinson's disease.
Yeah, this is a study in the very prestigious journal Gut. Now, I am, for a reason I don't understand, the chairman of the Gut Foundation, but I was the president. I said we should have a gastroenterologist as the president. And so the president now of the Gut Foundation is the editor of the journal Gut. And this big article looked at it was about, in total, we're talking close to 100,000 people, and looked at just under 25,000 people diagnosed with Parkinson's, about 20,000 with Alzheimer's, 24,000 with cerebrovascular disease like a stroke, and then another 25,000 who'd had none of those, so just age-match controls. And they found that people who had four gut conditions 5 years before the diagnosis, so we're talking about constipation, we're talking about functional dyspepsia, we're talking about gastroparesis, which means slow emptying of the stomach, or irritable bowel syndrome with diarrhea, any of those things 5 years before led to double the risk of Parkinson's disease and an increased risk for Alzheimer's disease and for cerebrovascular disease just by having those symptoms. So what they're saying is that there is clearly a big link between your gut microbiome and then your future risk for neurologic disease. So it's what we call the gut-brain axis. That's number one. Number two, another study published in a journal called Cell, Host and Microbe out of the Mass General, which is said to be the best hospital in the world. It's the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. I don't know where they got that title from, but anyhow, this looked at 1,200 people during routine colonoscopies looking for whether they did or didn't have different types of polyps. And they found that compared with people without polyps, as to people who had a thing called tubular adenomas, which are the ones that commonly lead to bowel cancer, or to sessile polyps, which don't particularly lead to bowel cancer, but can, there were 19 different bacterial species in the tubular adenomas and 8 different bacterial species in the sessile polyps compared with people who had no polyps. So what they're saying is that the reason why this is important is if we can pick up these pathogenic bacteria early and get rid of them, we may be able to prevent more bowel cancers. Equally, it could be that just having the tendency to bowel cancer also attracts those particular bugs. We don't really know. That's called reverse causality.
The headline says, under the weird file, pig kidneys for humans, two research groups have successfully implanted genetically modified pig kidneys into human recipients.
Yeah, and this was one particular really clear case was a person who was brain dead and wasn't going to recover. So the relative said, we are happy for you to do this clinical experiment on our relative before we let him die. So for 32 days, they implanted these genetically modified pig kidney into this pig kidneys into this man, and the kidney worked. It actually did the job without rejection. And the reason why this is important is that, say, for example, in the US, there are 37 million people out of their 330 million people, so it's probably the same in Australia, just divided by about 15, with some degree of chronic kidney disease, and some of those have end-stage chronic kidney disease. But the problem is 40% of people on the waiting list for a renal transplant die within 5 years of being on the waiting list. So this is just a proof of concept that pig kidneys do work in humans, and it was only for 32 days, so we really don't know what the long-term effects are of this. But I think this brings up the whole concept of 3D printing of organs, using some sort of biologic scaffold and then implanting stem cells onto these to create kidneys or to create hearts or pancreases. This is the future of medicine, but I still think it's weird that we're talking about implanting human kidneys. They've used, we already use pig valves for the heart on numerous occasions, and bovine valves as well, so cow valves. So we are using animals for a whole lot of things, but this is now taking it to a whole new level.
Researchers have identified new genes linked to breast cancer, Ross.
Yeah, and this is important, because what we do know is that breast cancer is probably 200 different diseases, because there's a whole lot of different genes involved. And they found that when they looked at women over the age of 50, there were 30 specific genes. So when you think of genetic breast cancer, everyone thinks of the Angelina Jolie gene, the BRCA1 gene. But in fact, 30 different specific genes, six of them are very significant. And they actually came out with one very new gene they'd not heard of before, called MAP3K1. And in women over the age of 50, 40 different genes. So we're talking about the fact that, 40 genes for those less than 50, 30 genes for those greater than 50. So we're talking about the fact that there's a very strong genetic component to breast cancer. Now, none of this surprises me, because I say all the time that all modern diseases are genetic. Even our reaction to infections, our reaction to trauma is genetic. And this is why you often hear somebody who's otherwise fit in their 20s or 30s gets really serious COVID, because they have a genetic defect in part of their immune system responding to that virus. And in the same way, there's many different genes people are born with that are either activated or inactivated by environmental stimuli, and then the environmental stimuli brings it out. So, for example, if you have one of these very specific genes for breast cancer, and you have even one glass a day of alcohol, that may bring out that genetic abnormality and induce a breast cancer. If you're carrying too much weight with these genetic abnormalities, it may bring out a breast cancer. But often, having the fruits and vegetables every day, keeping your weight down, not drinking so much, can minimize your risk for any of these conditions. So the big message from this is your genes loads the gun, your environment pulls the trigger.
What are the common supplements? I'm just looking at my time here. Common supplements improving hearing loss. Now, this is not if you've had a problem with your hearing. This is basically old age being the problem for your hearing loss.
Well, interestingly, we all know the dangers of cholesterol as far as heart disease goes, which, as I've said to you on numerous occasions, is a bit overstated. But age-related hearing loss is associated with reduced cholesterol in the inner ear. So we don't want to then give people a whole lot of cholesterol-laden foods to stop their age-related hearing loss. But what they did do in a bunch of mice who were genetically primed to get age-related hearing loss, gave them what's called phytosterol supplements. Now, that may be similar, that may be familiar to many people, because there are all these margarines on the market that have phytosterols that allegedly lower your cholesterol. And the interesting thing is these are still putting a form of cholesterol, but phytosterols, which are like cholesterol, into the system. And when they treated mice with this condition, with these phytosterols, they markedly improved their tendency to go after this age-related hearing loss. So it could be something simple as just giving people phytosterol supplements may help age-related hearing loss. But the best message I can give from this study for everybody, there is a very common form of phytosterol that many of us enjoy every day. It's called avocado. And avocado is, I think, much better for you than these cholesterol-lowering margarines, because it's totally natural. There's no synthetic stuff in it. And it's got very strong phytosterols that have all these wonderful properties, and now it appears to even improve age-related hearing loss.
Couple of minutes left. One quick one. What is the difference between biological and chronological age?
Well, you see, you can look at somebody and you say, oh, they're 50 years old. They look 50 years old. You can look at someone and say, they're 70, but they only look like they're about 55. And that's because that often the appearance of someone is often you look at their organs as well and study different aspects of their organs, and their organs appear younger as well. So we now can assess people's vascular age. We're talking about looking at their immune age, their liver age, their kidney age. There's always their brain age. And so there, what your age on your birth certificate doesn't always correspond to what the ages of your organs and everything else that's going on. And there's a guy, I thought this was quite funny, a US billionaire called Brian Johnson, who's a 45-year-old. He spends millions each year in an attempt to reverse aging. He's on a rigid diet, he does regular exercise, takes buckets of supplements, and has frequent tests to analyze every aspect of his organ function. I thought this was funny. On one stage, he even tried injecting himself with his 17-year-old son's plasma. So I don't know how he's a billionaire if he's spending all this time doing this. He should be working to keep his money going. But it's just interesting, the concept of assessing people's biologic age. And I think we're moving towards that, to say to somebody, look, we've done all these different parameters looking at your biologic age, and you're much older than you should be chronologically. So we need to bring in these interventions to try and bring that back to the pack.
Okay, our time is up. I've got to go. So thank you, as always. You're a delight to chat with. I'm glad you're back home, back here safe and sound. And look, mate, I won't catch up with you for, well, at least I would suggest a month or so, because this time next Tuesday, I imagine, I'll be on the operating table for that procedure. So I won't be here for a while, mate. Okay.
Well, you stay in touch with me and keep me involved with every moment.
Thank you, Dr. Ross.
I've got to keep my mate Brent healthy.
Good on you, mate. Thanks, Ross.
Okay. Hello, mate.
See you, mate. Bye-bye. There you go, Dr. Ross Walker. And as I said, I won't be here for a while, so when we get back, we'll get back in touch with Dr. Ross and we'll take more questions and all those sort of things. We podcast our chat each and every week with Dr. Ross. If you missed any of the questions that he answered today and you'd like to listen again, you can do so. Go through our 2HD website here, 2hd.com.au.